These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, we will listen to a recent discussion with Kurt Otebinga Ortesen, where we explore the ideas and questions he presents in his film, We Rise for Our Land. Africa World Now Project is next. The question of land as a fundamental aspect of Africana liberation movements is an often neglected point of inquiry. Nevertheless, it is indeed ever present. Promisingly, there has been an uptick of more folk who are paying attention to the demands of Black radical thought and behavior that sought and seek to engage in understanding its material and non-material role in Black liberation. One such important treatment is Edward Anoche's Free the Land, the Republic of New Africa and the Pursuit of a Black Nation State. In dominant discourse, however, the question around land as fundamental to liberation is often couched in a warped sense of capitalist ownership, which highlights the fundamental contradictions ingrained in the imposition of a European modernity and its attendant political philosophy of liberalism, all of which has produced limited discourses around the idea and practice of rights. A discourse rooted fundamentally in what does it mean to be human as the development and maintenance of private property. All contradictions that radicals must also seriously engage when exploring questions around land and freedom. It cannot be lost nor taken for granted the totalizing nature of colonialism as a product of imperialist logics, as the neglect of internal critique often leads to the reinscription of the very power dynamics that movements say they intend to disrupt. Nevertheless, land has always been a fundamental aspect of Africana liberation struggles, no matter its manifestations. Anti-colonialist movements, anti-capitalist, Black consciousness in South Africa and Brazil, Maroon struggles. The Land and Freedom Army, who clearly articulate this in their practice of self-naming its struggle. Moreover, a reading of the large cache of demands, treaties, and platforms of various communities of Africana movements and organizations provide the historical material reality of this fact. Take, for instance, this very brief outline of some of the demands. As part of the Negro Convention movement of the 1840s, 1850s, the Immigration Convention held in Cleveland from August 24th to 26, 1854, free Northern Blacks not only called for an end to slavery, but demanded land. Of the five demands from the first Pan-African Congress, which included capital, the control of their labor, political participation, and education, the first demand is that the land and its natural resources shall be held in trust for the natives, and at all times they shall have effective ownership of as much land as they can profitably develop. The second Pan-African Congress demanded the return to Negroes of their land and its natural fruits, and defense against the unrestrained greed of invested capital. The third Pan-African Congress demanded the right of access to land and its resources. The fourth demanded native rights to the land and its natural resources, etc., etc. The 1930s saw the development of the idea of the Black Belt Republic, which proposed a Black autonomous state in the American Deep South, from which we saw the development of the African Blood Brotherhood and the work of Harry Haywood. The 1960s saw the formation of the Republic of New Africa. In the tradition of the 1930s proposal of a Black Belt Republic, the Republic of New Africa identified the southern states of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina as subjugated land. Of course, we have Black farmer land and cooperative movements throughout the Africana experience in the Americas, particularly from 1865 until today, which provide a platform for us understanding land as a fundamental component of Black liberation. But one thing you will notice in all of this is the contradiction of ownership. Ultimately, land in the epistemic and ontological purview of Africana peoples is understood not in the limited capitalist sense of ownership, but the transmission of communal practices of human stewardship as being primary caretakers of the planet. And when land as a fundamental component of Black liberation is centered, ideas around national identity, critical consciousness formation, human rights, citizenship, what it means to be human can be better mapped to understand the interconnectedness of the various manifestations of the global Africana struggle for freedom. A Black internationalism becomes clearly defined. the conditions within which each manifestation formed, the temporal spaces within which they responded, was a continuation of a long tradition of what Cedric Robinson called the Black Radical Tradition, rooted in the man versus human contradiction theorized and explored by Sylvia Winter. All of this is wrapped in the analysis of the nature of revolution presented by Amilcar Cabral and articulated by El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz as inspired by the praxis of Queen Mother Moore and Vicky Garvin, as we can see practiced by the Land and Freedom Army of Kenya and many other anti-colonialist, anti-capitalist, black radical movements on continental Africa and throughout the diaspora. Today, we will hear a recent roundtable discussion exploring the questions that Kurt Ortesen presented in this documentary, We Rise for Our Land. Kurt Otebenga Ortesen is an award-winning filmmaker from Cape Town, South Africa, whose work has been featured on a number of platforms, including Al Jazeera, ZDF, SABC, Hulu, etc. He has worked on six continents and directed and produced over 10 feature documentaries screened at international film festivals, universities, and colleges. Kurt Ortesen is the founder of Anzania Rising Productions, a company that aims to inspire young people through creative storytelling about Africa and the African diaspora. And he is a member of the Africa World Now Project Collective. Others you will hear in this discussion are Savi Horn, director of the North Carolina Association of Black Lawyers Land Loss Prevention Project, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, member of the Africa World Now Project Collective and assistant professor of history in the Department of History, Political Science, and Social Justice at Winston-Salem State, Dr. Yusuf Al-Belushi, assistant professor of global and international studies at the University of California, Irvine, Dr. Kamal Rashid, associate professor of educational foundations and inquiry at National Lewis University in Chicago, and yours truly, James Pope. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
And because we have such an incredible panel, I'm going to keep my comments very brief. We've talked about and really, you know, what animates Black geographies in practice and pedagogy. And I really, you know, suggest folks, you know, to take a look at the conversation that we had last month, which will be airing on Africa World Now Project in the coming weeks. But I want us to think really clearly about the centrality and the struggle for land in Black geographic imaginations and spatial practices and African indigenous knowledge systems and the African world and the diaspora. The centrality of land gives not only meaning and is inextricable to the necessities of life and balanced living. The locations of African history, Africana history, selfhood, identity, power, resistance, and healing. Land is then also a set of relationships and a system of knowledge, a way of thinking and knowing the world, understanding and naming the external and internal world. When we think about collective land and the struggle for collective land and what it supports and makes possible, it's also part of this process of decolonization, this long struggle to imagine or reimagine the spaces and places that we're living based on. And what we really see with the Rural African Women's Assembly is based on regenerative African indigenous knowledge systems, which is part of this ongoing decolonial project. And I think about some of our comrades in the African world or in the continent. So I'm thinking about particularly a Kenyan retriever and bearer of Africana cultures and histories, an environmental activist, Wangoi Wakamoji, who reminds us that Africana collective land-based struggles really articulate a regenerative framework for governance, for justice, for spirituality, for economics, for education, and for old and new Africana communities that are defined in accordance with a holistic reality of African worlds or Africana worlds as societies, ecologies, and spirits that are in relationship. So what I would like to do is really invite our panelists to share some of their opening remarks and reflections on the film. And as I said before, this is a cipher. So anyone I'm more than happy for people to tap in to really enliven and illustrate really the human, spiritual, material, and social realities and these burgeoning contemporary and past even grassroots movements for justice, liberation, and radical social transformation. So anyone, I know Dr. Pope. Savvy, don't be shy. Y'all are talkers. All of a sudden, you're shy. Just kidding.
Well, yeah, I mean, Kurt, really, thank you for the film and the grounding that it offers us, and us in the diaspora can really see ourselves in this film. And so from the land loss prevention perspective and my entry to that organization, I spent a year in Zimbabwe in 95, walking that land and visiting villages and reading a lot and meeting some Moyo and pimping some courses at the Agrarian Institute, meeting people and just getting mad as hell. I had never been so angry in all my life. And it was around just living in an African country in which 98% of all arable land and 96% of water rights were being held by 12,000 whites, settlers, and millions of Africans living in communal lands, which were like semi-arid. And then to add further insult to injury, the introduction of non-native trees to the region. And so you're getting it, you're being bombarded by settler colonialism, and then you're dealing with the transformation of the environment as a result of their presence. And just looking at these very tall trees that were just, I gotta plug in my
computer.
Sorry, I think we're back up. The eucalyptus tree and how they just root, they find the water. So they're like, they're just like the settlers, you know, they find the water and it's theirs. And villages are struggling to build homes and access to boreholes without even the technology. And it just really transformed my thinking. You know, I'm from Jamaica, I'm used to a lot of water, but at the same time, I've seen in my brief time there before immigrating to the US, the pollution of rivers from mining and how that has impacted the country in terms of the exploitation and the impact on public health. So the Zimbabwean situation then led me to come into the American South and dealing with Black farmers and their dispossession, and working for an organization, the North Carolina Association of Black Lawyers, that was founded on more radical civil rights principle. And they themselves were part of the group of lawyers who were very much interested in what was going on in Southern Africa and Africa in general in terms of the land question and how universal that land question is amongst us, and how that really situates everyone in the same boat and with very similar histories and reaction and degradation of our environment. And so, you know, it comes full circle. Kurt, watching this film was 95, and it's been a minute, and the beauty of the place still there, the struggle of the people, their energy, their voices were really so familiar that I felt a longing to be back there. And so, you know, I feel that where we are with the planet and the environmental burden and the cumulative risk to public health and to our bodies, that I think coming out of this pandemic, things can't be the same anymore. And if I think for Black folk, it has really internationalized the struggle once again around, it's not just about your civil rights, it's everybody's civil rights. And we have to find ways to come together to really defend our Pan-African existence and protection of our bodies and spirituality and Mother Earth. So yeah, I loved it. Thank you so much. I look forward to looking at some of your other pieces. Yeah, thank you. Dr. Tasneem?
No, thank you so much, Savi. I invite Yusuf and James to offer their opening remarks and reflections on the film, and particularly thinking about, you know, the ways in which legal mechanisms are being invoked as a way to actually, to provide some sort of, you know, protection and preservation in land, but then looking at like the ways the film really reveals these complexities of land tenure and the complexities of these legal systems. So maybe we can disrupt some of that conversation if we want to think about how do we, you know, really materialize taking the land back that's not based on using the legal frameworks, the very legal frameworks that dispossess and displace us and remove us from the land and alienate us from the environment.
I'm gonna digress to Brother Yusuf so he can go, and then I'll kind of pick it back because I got some rhymes in this cipher that I will share with everybody.
Oh, wow. All right, sounds good. Thank you, James, and thank you, Tasneem, for the invitation, and thank you, Kurt, for really a fantastic film. I want to echo what Savi said. It's really an impressive work, and it offers so much for us to think about in terms of both contemporary struggles and contemporary forms of global capitalism that we're struggling against. So it's an honor to be here and be in conversation with all of you. I'll just offer, you know, a few thoughts. You know, for me, the film really, it does a lot of work, like I was saying, but it in particular, I think, helps push back against or potentially beyond some of our traditional kind of radical anti-imperialist or Pan-African models of struggle, at least, and it does this, I think, in at least four ways in a productive sense, in the sense that it pushes us towards thinking. First is the documentary really centers the theme of settler colonialism, which is excellent. We're more used to thinking about settler colonialism either within the United States or within some of the more obvious settler colonies, former settler colonies, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. But it really centers the framework of settler colonialism for thinking about land and struggles around land today and its legacy. But what's interesting, I think, in this regards is that we get a sense of indigeneity as potentially conservative in Southern Africa, rather than just primarily progressive, as often is the case in indigenous struggles in Latin America today that we often turn to for inspiration. So that was one way in which I thought it kind of pushed back against some of our dominant understandings. Indigeneity is quite complex here. There's both indigenous land practices that the movements are drawing upon, but then there are the traditional authorities who have access to land. And in this sense, this points to a second problem, I think, that the documentary raises, which is the control of land and the rise of a Black elite. So we see here clearly that the structures of global white supremacy have not been dismantled, that many of the landowners remain white and multinationals, either coming from abroad to control land or local whites who were the settlers and have never left. We see that in a number of scenes throughout the film. But we also hear about the ways in which the descendants of traditional leaders, traditional authority figures, have managed to gain access to land and solidify access to land in the post-colonial moment as a part of a kind of distortive decolonization process, right? Kind of decolonization from above that further entrenches the traditional leadership structures that were really put in place under colonialism, right? So it's kind of a misnomer to call them traditional in that sense. So it's kind of a co-optation of decolonization that I think that the documentary really portrays quite nicely, but this does represent, seem to represent a really significant entrenched power base in the rise of a Black elite in the form of these traditional authorities that these communities are often struggling against in their struggle for access to land. Third, I thought the documentary really pointed to the complex nature of globalization, really what we could call a kind of second phase of globalization. So if the first round of globalization in the 90s and the early 2000s was really about a struggle against what we called a neocolonialism, a persistence of the United States and European colonial powers now using the IMF and the World Bank to maintain their access to natural resources in the former colonies, but now with flag independence for those former colonies. Here we have a whole new range of actors, right, that have pushed beyond that first round of globalization. It's a, and this is why I think it's globalization 2.0. So for example, Vedanta Resources, one of the central actors in Zambia, mining company, you know, I looked it up. It appears to be an Indian company that began as a scrap metal dealer in Bombay in the 1970s. And by the early 2000s, with the rise of globalization and the increased dispersal of capital accumulating firms around the world, it had grown tremendously and it required a majority stake in an Indian state aluminum business. Then it was listed on the London Stock Exchange in 2003, and it rapidly acquired additional companies. First, an Indian gold mining company in 2007, and then it bought assets from a then bankrupt American copper mining company based in Arizona in 2008. And I think that opened the door for it to copper mining, which is what it's doing in Zambia. So it's really an Indian firm that has outcompeted, in a sense, American capital, buying assets from a bankrupt American firm from a prior era, and now really engaging in this really horrific form of extractive mining in Zambia and polluting the entire area, as the documentary points out. Alongside Vedanta being an Indian-controlled company, we have ProSavannah in Mozambique. And here the actors are again Japan and Brazil triangulating with Mozambique in the form of, you know, development projects that the documentary argues and activists argue are really attempts to solidify land grabs. And so although that project appears to have ended, the documentary tells us in 2020, certainly these two examples point to the increasingly dispersed architecture of power that globalization 2.0 in a renewed scramble for Africa, whatever you want to call it, is, you know, blurring the geopolitical lines of who we might be struggling against. Fourth, I thought the documentary really pushed us beyond the kind of male dominant narratives of struggle that we have inherited from the past. And it moves clearly to the centrality of women-led community movements. Land and social reproduction are really central here, rather than the factory necessarily and the wage. So rural livelihoods are really what are struggled over. But alongside that, we also get a focus on production, or rather kind of extraction and small scale mining at the community level towards the end of the documentary. And here we see issues of the persistence of child labor and the struggle for access to land to make a living through kind of small scale extractivism. So the changing nature of work in this context of landlessness, that's a long-standing issue, but now in a new context where kind of formal employment or the ability to live off the land is kind of brought increasingly into question, I thought was really important. And so I think it's not a surprise that, and it's really useful, I think, that the documentary highlights a lot of these women-led community movements. So those were four ways that I thought it kind of pushed back against some of our traditional narratives of what we're up against and what struggle's about. You know, there were three more points I guess I would point to that I took away from the documentary. I'll try to be brief here. And I think this relates to some of what Tasneem was asking us about with regards to the legal structure as we can take recourse to it versus kind of movements. I think there were kind of competing visions of liberation that were on offer to us in the documentary, kind of a version of liberalism and a version of radicalism. And I don't know, I'd love to hear more. Kurt, maybe you can tell us more about some of these figures and their visions. For example, the Zambia Care for Nature and Sama Kearns seem to be suggesting that the land problem and the extractivist problem would be solved if everyone used the resources, you know, according to the law, as Tasneem indicated. Mm-hmm. She also implied that the kind of natural resources need to be extracted in order for the country to develop, to build schools. And in a sense, she's right. This is the perennial problem that governments, whether radical or liberal, face when they take power, right? The need to continue extracting natural resources. Certainly we've seen that in radical experiments in Latin America in order to pay for schools. But is that really what's happening? Is this developmental extractionism? And that's kind of what's the tension here. So I'm curious if she was implying something about the community small-scale mining project that we saw in the clip right before her. Was she saying they were doing something illegal and that's hurting the nation? Does her group, Care of Nature, think that the environment should be preserved at the expense of people's livelihood? So I wanted to know more about the different perspectives and kind of class backgrounds of these actors. She also productively implied that the kind of corruption of politics, which I think is a theme that certainly resonates throughout the world in our moment, right? That, you know, we can't turn to existing political parties for a solution here. It's really movements outside the state that offer a significant alternative vision. Mm-hmm. And related to that, there was a kind of this competing visions of liberation. There was, you know, this hint of community consultation in Mozambique. I can't remember if it was Flaida or Molina who was saying that, you know, there should be a process of community consultation when these extractivist firms or these contentions over land control are really debated. But what does community consultation mean? And she implies that it's a really thin process. So is it state-led community consultation? Is it community-led? You know, so we kind of get a sense of a neoliberal approach to democracy where people are viewed as through stakeholders versus the radical approach to democracy, which is really what I think the movements are embodying. So the last two themes, really briefly, were corruption of politics, as I already noted, just that people campaign for office in order to enrich themselves, regardless of their political orientation, apparently, to gain access to land. The absent representatives, right, at the state level, the MPs or on the local community level, the ward development committees and councillors, they only show up at election time. This is a problem throughout the region and the world, arguably. So it points to this kind of post-political condition when you think of politics through the state again, but politics remains alive outside the state in the form of social movements. And last, obviously, the documentary really nicely highlights the repression of activists and the stakes of struggle. You know, we've all debated this in the recent film Judas and the Black Messiah around Fred Hampton and the legacy of those struggles, the price that people paid for those struggles. And this strikes me as extremely important to remind us that in struggling merely for one's livelihood in rural areas throughout Southern Africa, really you pay a high price for taking on entrenched interests. So really enjoyed the documentary and looking forward to the rest of the conversation.
I guess everybody's looking at me. you know, one of the things that I enjoy about being on panels, particularly in this particular group, is that, you know, it allows me to kind of sit back and learn and sit back and think intentionally and also deeply about the things that we all care about. And this is very, very important in the context of this question around land.
We are currently listening to a recent roundtable discussion centered on exploring the themes, ideas, and questions that Kurt Ortesen raises in this documentary, We Rise for Our Land. Kurt Ortebenga Ortesen is an award-winning filmmaker from Cape Town, South Africa. He has worked on 6 continents and has produced over 10 feature documentaries screened at international film festivals, universities, and colleges. Kurt Orderson is founder of Azania Rising Productions, a company that aims to inspire young people through creative storytelling about Africa and the African diasporas, and is a member of the Africa Vote Now Project Collective. Others you are listening to include Savvy Horn, Executive Director of the North Carolina Association of Black Lawyers Land Loss Prevention Project, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, member of the African World Now Project Collective and Assistant Professor of History in the Department of History, Politics, and Social Justice at Winston-Salem State University, Dr. Yosef Al-Belushi, Assistant Professor of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Irvine, Dr. Kamal Rashid, Associate Professor of Educational Foundations and Inquiry at National Lewis University in Chicago, and yours truly, James Pope. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Continue to enjoy the program.
Context of this question around land. And to kind of piggyback off of everything that Brother Yusef just said, I think you got a camera in here, like looking at my notes, because my whole notepad is really literally, you know, of dealing with those particular points. But I wanted to point what I think, and thank you, Kurt, you know, for the work that you're doing, for the work that we're going to be doing, you know, for, you know, because there's so many different things. But I wanted to kind of encapsulate my comments and something I have been saying, you know, in particular, whether I'm teaching, whether I'm doing things in the community, that there are two fundamental gifts of European modernity. And I say gifts with tongue in cheek, because it's really not gifts, because we are actually sitting here talking about these things. And also Kurt is filming these things. You know, Attorney Horn is dealing with these things in the context of land extraction and all this other stuff. But these two so-called gifts are the redefinition of what it means to be human that comes out of a European epistemological and historical context as a justification for private property, right? And so what I think, and Brother Yusef, you can you know, tell me if this is a little off, but the fundamental contradiction that I think that Kurt has showed in this film really is what we all are dealing with, this contestation between ownership of land and this Black commons, the idea that we do not own the land. But yet we're trying to do this all within this cyclical pattern of a racial capitalist structure that permeates our very being and lived experience on a day-to-day basis. And when we think about that, when we think about, you know, colonialism itself, it disrupts everything, not just the way that we think in the context of land itself, but it disrupts our thinking process. As Kwame Ture used to say, capitalism makes us think that we're thinking. Right. And so these contradictions that we're dealing with are constantly rooting back to this idea of what it means to be human that was redefined as a justification for private property. So then the question becomes for me, and Yusef, I think you're absolutely correct. It's like all of these contradictions that Kurt has really brought out in this film of like, what are we actually struggling for? Specifically in the context of, are we trying to usurp the landowners, right? You know, the so-called idea of what it means to own land in a colonial process, you know, in any type of colonial, whether it's neo-colonial, old colonial, direct colonial. But I think that we really this reconceptualization of what we're doing and what we're fighting for becomes very, very important that you're alluding to. You know, Yusef. And I think Kurt does this in the film just brilliantly, you know, just being able to just let the film kind of speak, let the people speak for themselves, which I think is very important because it allows us to be in community and thinking with folk who are actually dealing with these, whether they're trying to use law, whether they're trying to fight against it. So the question, I think, is a fundamental question that I think that we're all are dealing with, that they, that the folk who are getting evicted, the folk homes who are being taken on a constant, they're dealing with it directly, right? You know, we're all sitting here in our homes, right? Having a conversation, you know, about something, you know, that is happening here in the United States, as Attorney Horn knows, right? You know,
yes.
Kurt knows this, right? So I don't know. I don't have too many answers, so to speak. It's more like a conversation, and I think it's important, but it's a conversation that I think that needs to be had in consultation with the folk on the ground who are struggling, who are dealing with this. And like, you know, this notion of racial capitalism, which I also, as a point that I'll add to Youssef's, which, how many points you had? You said about 10, 11 points. I'll put 11 up here, put 12 up here, is that what it does is it shows how deeply racial capitalism has permeated the very existence of what it means to be human, whether you're in an African city, whether you're in a United States city, or whether you're out in the so-called bush, or you're out on the outskirts, it permeates, you know, and I think that we're dealing with those on a day-to-day basis. We all are dealing with them. What does it mean? What does it mean to struggle for land? What does it mean in ownership? You know, which is a very, very interesting question, because if we have an African indigenous knowledge system that says that we do not own the land, what are we actually trying to do when we're trying to struggle for land in this particular case? So I just wanted to say that I'm shut up right now and let Kurt, because Kurt, we set this task for you, set the terms of engagement for you, you know, and hopefully, you know, and I see people up here that look very familiar, please, by all means, jump on in this conversation as well.
Yeah, really, James, you're so right, because I'm looking at what's going on in our own land struggles here, and coming off the recently passed federal law around Black Indigenous people of color. Farmers and looking at how it's structured somewhat around the Olmstead Act, which is like one of the most, I mean, it was a complete taking of Native American land and led to genocidal wars in the taking of it. And so for us to be, looking at re-entering the new Black agrarian movement on land that is so contested, it is very problematic. And in the midst of Native Americans wanting to rematriate their land, they want it back. And for us to continue to walk that line on how we view property. And so I think it's some work around that us in the Black land space will have to grapple with. And I think this film informs that. You know, what is this about property? that we feel such a strong affinity for, and why is the privatization and ownership of it, you know, the thing that we desire the most, and it just can't be.
I mean, this is so generative, and I want to invite Kurt into the conversation as well, because, you know, you've laid out just really the contours and the contradictions and complexities of the struggles that we're waging. And I would love for you to actually really pick up and respond to some of these questions that Youssef and James and Savi had laid out. Because, you know, this is, you know, I was thinking about, and one of my questions kind of for you was thinking about how you became involved with the Rural Women's Assembly in Southern Africa, which was constituted about a decade ago. And it, you know, we look at Eswatini and Mozambique and Zambia, but it covers over 9 countries. And it has maintained its sort of local grassroots, focused on women in rural areas, focused on poor African women, small farmers. And so, if you can lay out some of these competing visions that we of freedom that we see, and we're, you know, watching those sort of play out, and thinking about the ways too, why it's so important. I mean, all of us are really grounded and centered in community-centered work. Even the way in which we teach our classes, it's always about community-to-community engagement, right? And the types of research questions and the types of intellectual work that we do stems from these questions that we, you know, we're coming from our own communities, and then working with communities, you know, in this larger global conversation and global solidarity movements, to think about, you know, what are we really struggling for, right? When we're thinking about radical social transformation, it's not about the reproduction of private property. It's not about the reproduction of a racial capitalist society. It's about thinking about a world, right, that doesn't require any of those systems or structures. So please, I'm gonna stop.
Yeah, thank you so much. Firstly, for showing the film, showing my work, and thank you so much for all the panelists, for your input. It's really encouraging and inspiring, because I think, you know, a lot of times as an artist, you know, you sit in your corner, you create, you know, your idea, and you go out and make it, and then, you know, you offer it, you know, you make it as an offering to society. And I hope, you know, with the idea of inspiring people as well, you know, as you're creating art. I mean, myself, you know, I'm from a settler colony known as South Africa. And more specifically, I grew up in Cape Town, which represents the epitome of the settler colonial project, right? And so, you know, one is that, you know, I mean, this narrative and the story around the land question is a very personal one to me. One is, you know, both my mom and dad, you know, their families were dispossessed from their land, you know, during construction of South Africa as a republic, pre-1910. The 1930 Land Act, obviously, you know, was critical with Black families losing land permanently. And so my mother's side, you know, they grew up, you know, in the rural part of the Western Cape, with where, you know, wine farms are basically the kind of main one of the main kind of contributor towards the GDP in South Africa, the wine exports, and so you have this history of plantocracy that's been going on, you know, with the inception of slavery in South Africa, and more specifically in the Western Cape. So, and then obviously with, you know, various, with the establishment of apartheid, 1948, there was the introduction to the Group Areas Act, right? And so again, my mother and my father, you know, they both, their families were dispossessed again, like second, third time, right? So, you know, I inherit this long history of people who've been dispossessed from land. And obviously with I know just from a historical perspective, 1652, right, was obviously when the bomb was dropped in South Africa. And this is obviously, you know, direct correlation to my own, you know, ancestral history and story with the disposition of land, disposition of people's identity, language, culture, a disruption of you know, their society. So, having created and been dealing with the issue around land reform, it's, you know, it's something that, you know, obviously in terms of, as you know, I also, prior to making films, I, you know, I was also involved with activism work, grassroots activism, specifically where I'm from. I'm from a township on the Cape Flats. Intersectionality of struggles, of social movements, you know, it's basically, I've been my political schooling. And I started really dealing and touching on, and really trying to understand this idea of, you know, what does the healing process and the restoration of memory mean if one kind of reimagines the idea around liberation, right? And this is directly correlated to the land question, right? And so, you know, having, you know, made a number of films around, you know, the land question, I, you know, was involved with the rural women's various different organizations, and having, you know, made films, advocacy work, using film specifically as an as an activist tool, and, you know, like facilitating various workshops with rural women, teaching them how to document their own story. These are all kind of been, I guess, a creation of a pedagogy that I've been thinking about and thinking through, as I'm working in Africa and traveling around the world and working with the broader African diaspora as well. And just seeing these correlations, right? You know, working in, you know, the South, you know, I, at some point, Dr. Sivi, I was actually working working with some local farmers actually in New Orleans. And just like moving between South Africa or the continent of Africa and the US, I just saw this, all these colorations. So I think what I'm trying to do really in my work is to kind of, one is to create solidarity, right? Kind of Pan-African solidarity, using film as a vehicle for transnational solidarity at the same time. Because this is, there's just so many correlations, right? With the indigenous struggles here, struggle of Black America and just the broader, I mean, discourse around people of color and people who've experienced colonization, right? And the trauma thereof and intergenerational trauma of that process. I think land, the land question is integral to the ideas around how do we think through the ideas around liberation, right? And I think coming to also to the idea around, you know, this, I think Dr. Yosef's was really fascinating, made an interesting point around the second 2.0 form of the neoliberal project, right? Around how these, you know, so-called kings and queens, you know, have co-opted themselves within this capitalist project, right? And so now you have the idea, I mean, the discourse around how people who are working the land, you know, have to basically still fight, you know, for the, but it comes back to, I think even Dr. Pope spoke, you know, so eloquently about this idea of, you know, the quest, the philosophical question around, or the moral question about this idea of ownership, right? And I grapple with myself, and I think just working, you know, with various movements in different parts of the world, that we are really custodians, right? Of the land, you know, and we have to preserve, right? And it was really, I think, the inception of global capitalism and enforced through white supremacy, right? That a price tag was attached to the ownership of land, right? Mm-hmm. And we've co-opted, we bought into that project. So mm-hmm. how do we undo that? How do we decolonize that process, that thinking, and then reimagine a kind of nuance, a new zeitgeist moment, right? And I think, obviously, we right now figuring out what's that new move, that new zeitgeist moment. I mean, we're dealing with the global pandemic. And so it's kind of interesting equal footing, right? So it's almost like there's a buffer zone now to think through reimagining the idea around liberation and decolonizing the ideas that we've been schooled, right? You know, through a capitalist, you know, system. And we've bought into it. So for me, the real critical question is also the idea around the nation state, right? You know, what does it mean, you know, for citizenship, for belonging? And also that's linked to the idea of land, right? And farming the land, working the land, and feeding yourself and your family and community, and exchanging as well, right? The idea of, you know, because, you know, there's a famous song by Burning Spear, social living is the best, right? You know, so for me, that's you know, ideally what I'm trying to do in my work is to show that, you know, this idea around socialism and community engagement and community sharing of ideas as a critical way of thinking through decolonizing, the question around decolonization.
I see Dr. Rashid is in the house. And so I was like, did you want to make it? I mean, when you turned on your camera, so you look like you wanted to say something. So let me give you the opportunity. If you would love to tap in into this cipher, I want to give you the opportunity to do so.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I turned the camera on because I teaching on Zoom, you see the black squares and it's really demoralizing. So I really hate the idea. I don't like talking to black squares. I figure other people don't like it either. So, but just to, you know, I really appreciated the film. I didn't get to see all of it because I was running from a meeting to this, but I appreciate it. It was a couple of things that stood out to me. One of them was something that the Yusuf mentioned that I really appreciated is that these dual conceptions of futurity. And this is the thing like about why I really appreciate the film so much, Kurt, because there are these notions of futurity implicit in economic within policy, as well as implicit in terms of the types of campaigns that people embrace. And so on one hand, you have this neoliberal future that people are striving for and this other still defined conception of the future grounded in notions of communalism. And that is particularly intriguing to me. And one of the things that it makes me think about, it reminds me a lot of some of the things that we're dealing with locally here in Chicago. So my wife and I have an urban farm on the southeast side of Chicago. And on one hand, we have a city administration that positions itself, and at least in terms of a lot of the language, is being very progressive. You know, so if you think about a lot of the discourse that came up a few years ago around police reform and the killing of Laquan McDonald, on one hand, you have the administration positioning itself as being very progressive, but on the other hand, you have the administration, especially over the last 12 months, take some moves that are very indicative of a posture of maintaining the existing white supremacist system. And this has also been, this is the complexities of this are compounded with respect to land, because on one hand, you have these people who are urban farmers who see the land as something which is not just something that gives people food, but is an anchor of cultural memory, you know, an anchor of historical memory, a glue of the formation and the reformation of community. But then you have this other consciousness, this other worldview, this other paradigm that sees land as a commodity. And these, I don't want to say they're irreconcilable realities. I'm not going to say that right now, but these are two very distinct ways of seeing and being in the world. And the thing that it makes me ponder is what does this look like in terms of movements? Because the thing that Kurt mentioned, and I think maybe Yusuf and James mentioned it also, is this question of struggle. Like, I think generations prior to ours, I think had very clearly delineated pathways of struggle that they were engaged in, right? In terms of how they conceptualized the decolonial struggle or how they conceptualized the struggle against, you know, white supremacy and civil rights within this settler colony that we live in. But we live in this very strange space where what is often articulated as freedom is actually a reinscription of the neo-colonial system. And so, like, for me, it's always this question of what are the paths forward, recognizing that is necessary to avoid oversimplified representations of what that type of politics should be. But at the same time, there has to be an anchor which grounds this work and compels this work going forward. So that was it generated questions, something that I need to ponder, but I definitely appreciate, you know, any insights you all could lend with respect to that. And Savi, I definitely appreciate what you said about the land, because these are conversations that my wife and I are constantly having about land and land access and how the state apparatus is often a barrier to people's actualizing their right to self-determination, which people are doing innately all the time, and they are constantly warred upon by the state. So I'll stop with that.
And I want to open it up to anyone that wants to respond to each other as well too. Please feel free to do so. I did have a question. You know, I kind of wanted actually Yusuf to kind of bring in some of the work that he's been doing, especially around the shack dwellers movement, and to think about, you know, we have the case study of the rural Southern African Women's Assembly, but also thinking about, you know, the motivating factor around the shack dwellers movement and how they're mobilizing and how they're organizing each other in informal settlements and for what purpose, and how we can think about these as part of this larger sort of like landscape that's of these various movements that are interconnected in Southern Africa that also reveal these sort of complexities and contradictions, but help us try to think about a path forward to futurity that's not about, you know, reproducing a racial capitalist society, but is constantly thinking and moving us towards, you know, this communalism, a community, you know, and it can be informed by, sometimes it's informed by communism, sometimes it's informed by socialism, but it's rooted in a much more sort of ancient tradition of caring and stewarding for each other and the land and nature.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, of course, I was thinking about South Africa and the shack dwellers as I was watching this, you know, that moment in the film where the woman is talking about how the counselors are absent, the ward counselors are absent, except on election day. I mean, that could have been an exact description of the kind of, you know, critique of local ANC officials in South Africa, certainly on the part of the shack dwellers movement. They make the exact same denunciations, the same denunciations of corruption within the state in terms of how they take advantage of purportedly developmentalist policies like the distribution of houses in order to further entrench their control in only ANC supporting communities. So the kind of commodifying of supposedly developmentalist assets that the state provides for poor people. The other thing that I think was so useful in thinking about the shack dwellers in Durban is that the shack dwellers offer us a kind of urban side of this story that Kurt was saying he also comes out of, coming out of Cape Town, right? That the struggle around land, we tend to view it purely as a rural issue. And, you know, that rural urban divide has historically been quite problematized. We know the history of the kind of circular migration patterns that the apartheid system really relied upon. And that's continued up into the present. And one of the interesting things about it is this kind of scrambling of that urban-rural divide today. But the struggle for land is certainly just as much an urban struggle as it is a rural struggle, I think, in these different countries. The other thing that I think resonated was, and I think Kurt was gesturing to this, talking about Pan-Africanism and the desperate need to revive Pan-Africanism in this current moment, particularly if you view this issue from the South African vantage point where we've seen this horrific rise in xenophobic attacks against these very same countries, right? Migrants from these same countries, from Mozambique, from Eswatini, within South Africa. Now there's a way in which the state has produced a xenophobic kind of anti-African discourse as though Africa's out there, not in South Africa. And so the need to understand these interconnected struggles, exactly what the film does, and to do so by taking us to places that are much less traveled, right? Zambia, Mozambique, and Eswatini, so important. And to show the kinds of conditions of landlessness, which generate the exact same as of international cross-border migration that shack dwellers in Durban have also endured, whether it's from rural KwaZulu-Natal into urban South Africa. So I think that it really generates the possibility of solidarity in thinking of struggles across national boundaries, in thinking of much more global architecture of power that we're up against, rather than the kind of short-sighted attack on national governments as the end-all be-all, because of the patterns and the similarities that we see between these different countries.
You were just listening to a recent roundtable discussion which explored the themes, ideas, and questions that Kurt Orterson raises in his documentary, We Rise for Our Land. Kurt Otabenga Orterson is an award-winning filmmaker from Cape Town, South Africa. He has worked on six continents and directed and produced over 10 feature documentaries screened at international film festivals, universities, and colleges. Kurt Orterson is the founder of Anzania Rising Productions, a company that aims to inspire young people through creative storytelling about Africa and African diasporas, and is a member of the Africa Vote Now Project Collective. You also heard Savi Horn, Executive Director of the North Carolina Association of Black Lawyers Land Loss Prevention Project, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, member of the Africa Vote Now Project Collective and Assistant Professor of History in the Department of History, Politics, and Social Justice at Winston-Salem State University, Dr. Yusuf Al-Balushi, Assistant Professor of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Irvine, Dr. Kamal Rashid, Associate Professor of Educational Foundations and Inquiry at National Lewis University in Chicago, and yours truly, James Pope. Thank you for listening. Due to time constraint, you can listen to the entire program on Africa World Nail Project's SoundCloud. Just search Africa World Nail Project. That's it for Africa World Nail Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We could be reached through all your regular social media platforms, email africaworldnailproject@gmail.com, or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ, or Instagram at Africa World Nail Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Nail Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Montali, Africa World Nail Project media correspondent Funa Ngonda, senior research content contributor and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior research content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technologies, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Nail Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC 90.5 FM, NPR affiliate and broadcast service of Winston-Salem State University. Programs are archived and available on all podcast platforms. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.
Black nose. Understand. Get it before.